Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
This is the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about leadership and management with government executives and thought leaders who are truly changing the way government does business. Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors, a special series focusing on leading through uncertain times, exploring qualities, tools, tactics, and mindset government executives may need to navigate unsettling times and transform order out of chaos. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. What are design principles and tools for innovation? How can design principles and practices help government executives transform how government does business and meet its missions? And what strategies can leaders employ to achieve a design mindset? I'll explore these questions and so much more with Sarah Stein Greenberg, author of Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. So, Sarah, welcome to the show. It's great to have you.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's really great to be here.
So I'd like to start off with some sort of context for our listeners. Would you be able to tell us more about the history and mission of the D School at Stanford University?
Yes, that is a great place to start. So the D School is kind of an unconventional institute. We are a part of Stanford's campus, and there are actually seven different schools at Stanford. We kind of sit right in the middle of it all. We have a program that reaches students from all of those seven schools. So you might, in a D School class, be sitting next to a medical student and an electrical engineer and a public policy student. In fact, you might even be all on the same team with that kind of range of backgrounds and disciplines. And the reason they're all taking classes at the D School is because they are looking for ways to strengthen and build their creative abilities and apply them to the things that they find meaningful. And so for some of our students, that might be they are, you know, interested in figuring out how do I innovate in public education? Or for others, it might be a straight up business kind of application. They want to start a new company. They're thinking about entrepreneurship. And for others, it might be that, you know, together while they're in their D School class, they get handed a really interesting open-ended problem. And together, they actually come up with some kind of innovation that they think is worth launching. And so we see a number of students every year who actually bring the idea, the service, the product that they've created while they're at the D School and try to launch it and try to implement it. And I will say that this the interdisciplinary composition of both our student body and also our faculty and industry experts who come together to teach, that is very much by design. We really believe that the kinds of challenging, open-ended problems that we all face today and the opportunities that are out there, they require looking at these opportunities differently, kind of through different eyes, if you will. And one of those magic ingredients that often helps with that is the diversity of perspectives that you can get across disciplines.
So when folks hear of the D School, you could mean diversity of disciplines, but it really means design, right? So what is design in this context? And to what extent is it similar or distinct from the concept and activity of design thinking? And what does it mean to have a design mindset?
So a design is a really fascinating field that has been evolving, you know, for the last 100 years or so. And I think a lot of people, you know, are really familiar with the aspect of design that is about creating, you know, physical objects, that is, you know, about doing that in an elegant way, designing particular tools to meet a particular need. But in the last 25 or 30 years, design has gone through a really big stage of that evolution and has started to be pulled into all kinds of problem solving. And as that occurred, the need for people from all of these different backgrounds, you know, different functional areas in companies or organizations, people with different disciplinary perspectives, they really needed a common vocabulary. And design thinking, I think of as that common vocabulary, that way to think about, well, what part of design work am I in right now? Am I in a stage where I really need to be what we call flaring and increasing the number of ideas or potential solutions that we're considering? Or are we in a focusing mode? And in fact, we need to be selecting and evaluating and deciding what is the criteria for evaluating what small number of ideas we're going to move forward into the next stage. And that kind of shared mental model is the need for that is really what I think gives rise to design thinking. The way that I think about design is it is a really flexible problem-solving approach. And when you have a design mindset, you are thinking about both how do I drive and discover the big vision for what the future might look like as I'm coming up with my solutions or my ideas for the kind of change that I want to make, the kind of offering that I want to create. And also, you are fascinated by and really attending to all the little details. And that kind of big range, that's what I think of when I think of designers who I really admire. My colleague Thomas Both really said that to me once, that, you know, the business of being a designer has to do with like driving that big vision and caring about all those little details. And being able to go back and forth between those two layers and levels is the mark of a great designer.
You know, perhaps you could highlight some of the core principles and tools and techniques taught at the D School.
So we are really interested in figuring out how do we help people unlock their creativity, particularly as applied to the kinds of relevant challenges that we all face today. So, and I'll just give you an example, like we are all, living through a time when each one of us is waking up every day and solving problems or addressing challenges that none of us were really trained for and that are quite challenging. And that's true whether we're thinking about just like in a family context, you know, the huge numbers of parents who had to assume new roles in the past 18 months, you know, being a coach or a teacher at home, thinking about as we're now, some of us are starting to go back to an office environment, what the new kinds of etiquette and norms are going to look like, you know, the kinds of more regional or nationwide challenges around climate change, around all kinds of social change that's happening. All of those challenges come with a fair amount of ambiguity and uncertainty. And that is really a perfect context for the kinds of skills that you learn in design to show up. And those skills have to do with being able to kind of arrive at a new challenge and have a routine way and a set of tools to confront that challenge. So often one of the first things that we do is we ask students to create maps, to do a whole bunch of contextual research, to understand the systems and the history and the background, the context that has shaped the particular problem that they're interested in, but not just to do secondary research, also to go and really observe the environment, to talk to individuals, to conduct depth interviews, and to try to understand both at the systems level and the individual human level what some of those different experiences are. And I'll give you a great example of this. We had a group of former students who, after they graduated, they went on to start working in the state of Michigan around the challenge of redesigning public benefits. And public benefits in Michigan at the time had an extremely long and cumbersome application process, and it had many, many different stakeholders. And our alums, Lena and Adam Selzer and Michael Brennan, they started with that human level. They started doing interviews. They started understanding the system. They interviewed both people who were applying for benefits, but also lots of people who worked within the system and were trying to provide the services. They were the caseworkers. They were the administrators. And through that process, they recognized that there were a number of opportunities for significant improvement. And then through experimentation, what we call prototyping, coming up with new ideas and rapidly testing them before you actually move into implementation, that process allowed them to design a much shorter process that costs less and that actually engages people in a much more human way. And that project has been such a success that they're continuing to work with the state of Michigan on helping to redesign other aspects of the public benefits system.
So, Sarah, you mentioned the public benefits efforts in Michigan. Is there a specific industry or sector that has truly inculcated the use and application of what is taught at the D School, or are its approaches used and applied by many sectors?
Yeah, you know, there's definitely, a strong association between design and the private sector in general. That really came about in kind of the post-World War II era. But in this, the past several decades, the design really is being drawn into all different kinds of sectors. So there are many people within the K-12 education system who are really interested both in how design can help redesign schools and education, but also how younger students may benefit from learning some of these same tactics and skills early on. People in the public sector are using it increasingly, as in the example that I just gave in Detroit and in Michigan. In healthcare, there is a real interest in using design to become what we call more human-centered, right? And to look at healthcare problems and healthcare systems through the lens, not just of patient outcomes, but of the patient experience, even of the family experience and the clinician's experience. So there are so many different places where design is being seen as a tool to really innovate and come up with new and better approaches to complex challenges.
So, I love the title of your book, Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Sarah, what's the goal of your book and what prompted you to write it?
Well, I think it really goes back to this idea about these challenging times that we're all in. My colleague, Lisa K. Solomon, who's a futurist, she just made this wonderful observation one day, which is, none of us took a class in college about how to navigate ambiguity, but that is the fundamentals of what we teach at the D School, right? It's like, so now we've arrived in this moment and a lot of us feel pretty unprepared. But actually, when you have a routine way to approach a new challenge as a learner and with ways to unlock your own creative abilities, you are far more likely to be able to meet those ambiguous challenges of the moment. And I just have a very strong level of conviction that design is an important part of solving some of those big challenges that we face today. And of course, the reality is that, most people won't, get a chance to come see us in California. And so I really wanted to take what I think of as some of the best and strongest ideas, and not just the ideas and the skills, but really even the way that we teach them at the D School, and share that with as broad an audience as possible. And that was really my goal in writing the book.
So, when I think of design, I think of people, I'm not a very good, I can't draw, but I'm thinking about spatial things, the thing that you're creating, the ability to spatially capture it. But why do you believe design is for everyone?
Well, I guess I would say, I hear that comment a lot of, I can't draw. And it's really often like one of the first things that people say to me. I can't draw, I'm not a designer. Maybe you didn't say this, but perhaps some people are like, I'm not that creative. But actually, Michael, I think you are a designer, even in the way that, you're creating a way for your audience to be in the conversation with us, and thinking about the interests, the specific interests and needs that they might have. That's a very human-centered design process. And thinking about like how to, what's the pacing, what's the different ways that you might approach this topic. All of that is incredibly intentional. And I think that's really what I mean when I say design is for everyone, that the insight and the caring and the really like the audience-centered approach for many storytellers, for many hosts, like that is a form of design. I think it's different than what many people might expect, but I think it's the same core principles. And I think, you know, the more intentional we are about what we make and create and put into the world, the better. The more likely it is to really resonate with someone, the more likely it is to create positive change, perhaps the less likely it is to create unintended consequences. So that kind of intentionality and that kind of dedication to the craft, that is what we can all learn from design and what we can all embrace.
That's wonderful. So, you know, I want to get into specifics about some of the tools and exercises, techniques that you provide in the book, because it's a, as well as it tells the story of design, it's a really practical book from my reading of it. And, you know, I was wondering, Sarah, what role does the concept of contextual awareness play in the effectiveness of design? And more importantly, how does the concept, if you will, of experience sharing and perspective taking factor into this?
Those are wonderful questions. I think that the first thing I would just want to say is that, you know, we have some real myths in our culture about where creativity comes from. And one of those myths is the idea that like a spark of genius will, you know, somehow strike someone like lightning. And then all of a sudden you're going to have a brilliant new idea. And all of a sudden, you know, it will manifest in the world. And actually, there's a lot of hard work that goes into producing things that are creative and that are innovative. And one of those elements is both understanding the context that you're designing for and understanding the experience of the other human beings that are in that context. And, you know, I think part of, you know, at the roots, the early days of the D School, that was one of those ideas that we're really trying to spread, which is that idea of instead of just looking inward at your own point of view and through your own lens, look outward before you find, you know, before you actually even say, oh, I know what the problem is that I'm trying to solve. So we do a lot of work with our students around how do you understand other people's needs? How do you understand their beliefs? And of course, you're never fully going to be able to walk in someone else's shoes, but how do you actually incorporate the views of more than just you and your own individual team into the design work that you're doing so that you can have a deeper appreciation for what people actually might need and care about and use when you're working as a designer? So experience sharing and perspective taking are actually two components of what we in a sort of popular way call empathy. There's a third component as well called pro-social motivation. And these are the experiences and that what's happening for us cognitively when we are empathizing with another human being, when we're actually feeling what they're feeling, or we think that we're feeling what they're feeling, and when we're taking their perspectives into account. And that often, in my experience, when I see students really working and striving to gain empathy for others, it provides this kind of urgency. It provides this sense of, wow, I've seen this need in the world. And I may not have really understood that that was a need. For example, the work that was happening with the, you know, public benefits process, right? But actually, once you start to understand and to care about the human beings that are involved in that very complex system, you sometimes start to feel, oh, I really feel like I have an obligation to try to do something here, to try to create something that could be of assistance and could change the situation for the better. And I think that's one of the real hidden benefits of incorporating an empathetic stance and working to have empathy as a part of your design work.
Yeah, that's a great lead into my next question about, if you're talking about empathy, how do you translate that empathy into insights and design direction? And how could one avoid, I think you refer to it as the creative savior complex?
Yes. Well, let me come back to the creative savior complex. I want to touch on that specifically. I think, you know, one of the stories that I tell in my book is a story of four of our students who founded an organization called Neura Health. And this was a team of interdisciplinary students. Two were on their way to becoming doctors. One was a policy student and one was a civil engineer. And the hospital that they were working with and that they were going to do a design project with is based in southern India. And I think they really had this idea at the beginning that they were there to help with the efficiency and the scale and the low cost model of this hospital. This hospital is an amazing chain of hospitals that provides very high quality care, but their aim is to do it at a large scale and at a low cost. So the students kind of went in with one set of ideas. And one of the things that they noticed was that there were a lot of people waiting in the hallways. And they got really curious about what was going on and actually learned that a lot of these folks were people's family members who had accompanied them sometimes for, you know, over long distances and were waiting in the hospital along with them. And then when they started conducting some interviews, they realized, oh, these folks are pretty anxious. And they're pretty scared. They don't have a lot of information about what's going on. So the students really wrestled with this because on the one hand, it felt very far outside of the scope of what they thought they were there to work on. But the empathy that they developed in hearing some of these stories from family members and the anxieties that they held, they just really landed in a very powerful way. And so when they were in the process of what we call creating their point of view, which is the opportunity for people to actually frame the problem they're going to work on after they've started their research. So not at the very beginning, but not until, like, we defer that part of design work until you actually have had an opportunity to really immerse in the environment. And they decided that it was more important to them to really try to meet the need of those family members. And they wound up actually creating this incredible education and training program in which they train their organization, Neura Health, trains healthcare providers, largely nurses, all over South Asia to deliver educational programs to those waiting family members. And what happens is that then with a little bit of education about how do I take care of my father who's just gone through heart surgery, or my sister who's just gone through a difficult birth and delivery. When those folks armed with this new health knowledge help take care of their family member once they return home, it reduces the rate of preventable hospital readmissions. It reduces the rate of complications, as well as really addressing that anxiety, because you're just giving people information and knowledge is so, so important and empowering. So it's an amazing example of how, in this case, the students really developed empathy for what those family members were going through, and they allowed that to be their inspiration and to help them frame a problem that was really waiting in plain sight, but no one else had really observed and acted on. And they've launched this incredibly innovative program that is thriving all over India and I think in Bangladesh as well. The creative savior complex, which I promised to come back to, is a great thing to watch out for when you're doing this kind of design work, particularly where your feelings get involved. And I actually first read that phrase in an article that I was reading by a technologist and artist named Omayeli Aranyeka. And she just really did a beautiful job of framing up that, like, sometimes when you have empathy and you start to come up with all these ideas about how you can help, you feel a little bit like a creative savior. And you have to really watch out for that, because in fact, if you're an outsider in that ecosystem, you may not yet have the full picture. You may never have the full picture. You really need to work in partnership with the folks in that community, or in the case of our students, in the hospital system, and with patient advocates and the clinicians themselves. And you have to really become a part of the community and offer your skills, but not assume that those skills sort of set you up to deliver the amazing solution that no one else can come up with.
How can we make better sense of our insights? We'll explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns.
To support government financial performance and accountability, financial systems must meet certain standards, and relying on outdated financial systems inhibits progress. ERP vendors are encouraging clients to move to the cloud and consider new technologies such as robotic process automation, blockchain, and AI to enhance financial productivity. Download the IBM Center Report, Financial Management for the Future, at businessofgovernment.org to learn why and how government can evolve to meet the demands of a digital world. The Ebola crisis in West Africa from 2014 to 2016 was an epidemic that put emphasis on global capacity to respond to international disasters. How can government better assess the needs of those affected and help them? The IBM Center Report, Responding to Global Health Crisis, by Professor Jennifer Widner, breaks down the U.S. response to the Ebola crisis and provides insights on lessons learned that may aid the government responses in the future. Download your free copy, Responding to Global Health Crisis, at businessofgovernment.org.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour, a special series focusing on leading through uncertain times. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. My guest today is Sarah Stein Greenberg, author of Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Yeah, I'd like to switch gears a little bit and talk about some of the exercises and some of the practical advice you give folks in the book, and in particular, new ways of seeing. You know, you introduce terms like shadowing, prototyping, insight, sketching, reflections throughout the book. But I was wondering if you could, for our audience, you know, highlight some tools for seeing things in new ways and how these tools and techniques train our attention and possibly make the hidden visible and move beyond, you know, what's right in front of us, the obvious.
Well, this is one of my favorite cluster of assignments that I provide in the book. And you're absolutely right. I put a lot of the actual assignments that we teach at the D School in here because I actually want to get people trying new things, not only reading about them. So some of the assignments that really fall into this category involve allowing yourself the time and space to try to observe things in a new way with some, you know, specific prompts and some specific rules. So one, for example, that my colleague Carissa Carter teaches a lot is called the derive. And the derive is a way of taking, it means to drift in French. And it's the idea that if you train your attention in a very specific way, you will see new things that you maybe have been walking by for years that you didn't notice were there. So in the derive, you pick one attribute to follow, and perhaps you do this in your neighborhood or in you know, a large building. And you, for example, maybe you pick the color yellow and you see something yellow and you go investigate it. And then you see the next thing that's yellow and you drift over in that direction. And then the next thing. And just the act of isolating that one quality, your brain is starting to filter the information that's around you in a really different way. And all of a sudden you see new things and you think about new things. And I can't quite explain why it is so powerful, but as Carissa says, when people come back from doing a derive, it is the perfect way to kind of reset how your brain is thinking and observing the world. And another experience that you mentioned, which is called shadowing, is one that we use a lot actually in education, in K-12 education. And this involves the practice of choosing someone in your organization. It could be a customer, it could be a student, it could be you know, somebody who's a brand new hire who you want to really learn about their experience, but somebody who is having a very different experience of navigating the ecosystem than you are. And you simply follow them and shadow them with their permission, of course, for a full day. So with our educators, you know, they're going to meet the kid that they're shadowing at the bus stop in the morning. They're going to follow them all day. They're going to recess. They're going to math. They're going to lunch. And educators come back and have some, you know, wildly profound observations as a result of this. And part of it, again, is it's stimulating that, you know, degree of empathy to see things through someone else's eyes for a day. And it often gives rise to really important observations about where things aren't working or where things could be improved and where there's opportunity for innovation. So those are two examples of really powerful exercises. You know, one takes an hour, one takes a day, that can completely kind of reframe and tune up your brain in terms of how you're observing and how you're noticing.
I have to say, underscore the fact that there's a lot of real good insight, practical insight in your book, introducing these concepts and how to apply them. So really found it very interesting. Sarah, I was wondering, how can we make better sense of our insights? And what I'm going with this is, you know, tuning up our critical brain, uncovering connections, sort of interpreting information and forming hypotheses. How can we better do this? What's some exercise out there?
So we call this part of design work sometimes synthesis or sense making. And it is important because the kind of data that we look for and gather in design work is kind of messy data, right? Maybe it's some quantitative, maybe it's some qualitative, maybe we've drawn some diagrams of a particular set of interactions, and helping to connect the dots and then use that to figure out, where is the opportunity in this messy data? What are the needs that are really popping out that are compelling for me to address? That's the work of synthesis. And that's the work that these kinds of assignments will really help you do. So there's one that I really like that again, relates to the example that I gave of the folks working in Detroit. They have a particular practice that they created called the 100-foot journey map. And once they've gone and interviewed folks who are applying for public benefits and interviewed the folks who are the caseworkers and done a lot of observations, they will actually sit down and map out an entire process end to end. And in one case, as they were doing this, literally the whole thing took, it was 100 feet of paper. And that's partly because that system was so complex when they started working on it. And in each of those, as they're creating this very elaborate journey map, they're seeing where there are moments when things aren't working for either the person who's applying, but also aren't working for the person who's the case manager. And those are often really good places to start, because everyone can agree, wow, that thing needs to change. And maybe if that part changed, that there could be some positive ripple effects throughout the system. It's also often a way, when you have a set of stakeholders who aren't all quite looking at the problem in the same way, drawing out these kinds of maps, sometimes they're called service journey maps or just customer journey maps, they actually help people kind of see the data in these visual layers and recognize, oh, wow, my department, you know, we have the right objectives, but actually we're kind of getting in the way of this other department over here. And laying things out visually and creating an object that everyone can react to that's external is a completely different way of having that conversation. So in a lot of organizations, that same conversation will happen in a memo or it'll happen in a meeting, but there's something very, very useful about putting it into this physical visual artifact. And that's something that some of those maps can really help. Then people can actually come together and say, okay, we agree this particular place is the place where we're going to start to work to improve this system.
That's a wonderful context. You know, as I was reading your book, I was thinking it's sort of a clarion call for folks to unleash your imagination. I'm like, get out there and try to figure out how to create new ideas and, you know, generate new directions. And I was wondering, what advice or what kind of guidance could you give someone who's thinking, like, how do I do this? What's the best way to do this?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. And actually, you know, I think, again, back to those sort of myths about creativity, I think we have this sort of sense of, wow, some people are just really good at coming up with ideas. And am I one of them? I'm not sure, right? But actually, you know, there are different ways of approaching this work that we call ideation, just to lay, you know, more design jargon in there. There's, you know, sort of that refers to the broad category of activities in which you are coming up with ideas. And, you know, for some people, they really think best on their own. For other people, they really love the kind of group brainstorming experience, but everyone can use a little bit of scaffolding and prompting. And so, for example, one assignment that I love is called Experts Assumptions. And that's actually based on a practice called assumption storming. So most people have heard of brainstorming, but assumption storming is a practice that was created by a man named Craig Lauchner. And it asks you to think about and list, what are all of the assumptions that I have about the thing that I'm working on creating, or about what my department offers, or my, you know, how we're teaching at my particular school. And as you list all of those assumptions, then you move into a phase where you actually start to cluster them. Some of those are facts, some of those are opinions, and some of those are usually guesses. And until you actually disaggregate and start to sort those, you can actually obscure where there is room for change and innovation and coming up with those new ideas. And once you've identified those, you simply try the next step, which is you flip a few of those assumptions that are actually opinions or guesses. So you say, well, let's see, we've always taught this class before that class, but what if that weren't, that maybe that's actually just an opinion that that's the right sequence. What if we flipped it? What if we taught it in the opposite sequence? Whoa, what are all the new things that are possible as a result? Maybe students could do different kinds of projects. Maybe students would have different kinds of collaboration experiences. So just by challenging some of the existing assumptions, you figure out, oh, if I'm flexible and think about this in a new way, I'm actually developing space for where new ideas might be meaningful. And that actually helps you then start to come up with what those new ideas might be. Kind of new ideas that are just floating around in the ether without being tethered to something are sometimes fun to play with, but often they don't land anywhere. And so having that, like doing that work to kind of excavate the substrate first and figure out, well, where could my ideas land? Where is there a need for new ideas and innovative approaches? That actually helps you as you're then starting to come up with what those new opportunities and solutions might be.
That's a nice segue into my next question, which was, what does it mean to think with things?
Yeah, this is something that, you know, if you've ever walked into a design studio or somebody's like, you know, somebody who really loves building things in their garage, it is usually a very cluttered place. There are things everywhere. And that really reflects the fact that designers and engineers often really think with things. And there's some interesting research about the kinds of cognitive processes that get unleashed when you pick up objects and manipulate them. And, you know, everyone will have, or I hope everyone has the memory of being a kid and, you know, kind of reaching for the Legos before you even knew what you were going to build, or the blocks or the sticks. And just putting your hands on the physical things that you might then make something with sparks new ways of thinking about what you might make. And that's really what's meant by, you know, how, you know, you can think with things. And so you can incorporate that too into your own environment, whether that's, you know, because you are deliberately trying to come up with some new ideas, and having some of those materials at hand helps you play and think with your hands and sometimes with your body. Or if you're just trying to say like, well, I've got an idea and I want to express it to someone and I actually want to get some feedback on it, maybe I'll build it out of Legos. Right? How could I actually show someone in a, what we call a very low resolution medium, what I'm thinking about and give them a real chance to help me build on it and make it better?
That's a great point. So, you know, you mentioned earlier, Sarah, the journey mapping, and I was wondering, you know, perhaps you could have sort of a follow-up question along with maybe elaborating a little bit more on the practical application of journey mapping. But, you know, how does things like journey mapping and methods around design, how are they powerful tools for helping one to learn?
Yeah, I personally use journey mapping not just to help organize data and think about what the customer journey might be, but also as a tool for reflection on learning. And what I've done many times is that at the end of a class, I'll ask my students to reflect back on the 10 or 12 weeks that we've spent together and actually to map, make a personal map of that time and their experience during that time. And I'll ask them to draw one line that is the arc of their own learning journey. When were there moments when they felt like they were learning a lot? When were they not learning so much? And then in another color, to lay on a second line that charts how they were feeling over time. What was kind of their emotional journey? And one of the things that I see that help with is that it gives students a real understanding of what are some of the conditions under which they learn the best. And the thing that I often observe that I find completely fascinating is there is often a moment where students report that they were learning a lot, but they weren't very happy. They were stressed, they were anxious, they were nervous, whatever those more negative emotions were. And actually that gap, when you're learning a lot, but it doesn't feel very good, I think is evidence of what in mathematics education is called productive struggle. So when you learn something, or when you're trying to learn something in math and it's hard at first and you don't get it right away, it turns out that learning, it actually like lands with you in a deeper way. You're more likely to be able to transfer those skills to other contexts and to continue to use them later. So there's something about actually having to stretch a little bit beyond what you think you can do, which often doesn't feel great. It is anxiety provoking, but actually is where you're learning. And when students can actually see, oh, that was a moment when I was learning a lot, you remember that feeling, right? You remember that feeling of like, ooh, am I getting this? I got to work a little harder. How am I collaborating? What, you know, like, do I really understand how to navigate? All of those are actually, instead of being something that might shut you down in the future, that might be evidence that like, oh, you're working right at the edge of your capabilities and you're pushing forward. And I think that is a very powerful idea for all of us, regardless of whether we're students or maybe even more importantly, as we continue on in our careers, is one, to understand how we learn, because every single one of us needs to keep learning. And to understand that when we're struggling, actually, that's a sign that you are working on something that is, you know, demanding of your full faculties and abilities, and to keep with it, and that will actually set you up well to then solve the next harder and harder challenge.
You just mentioned an important point that you underscore in your book, and that's how we learn. And I have another question around, you know, I'd love for you to get your insights on what's the difference between the experience of how we learn versus, or complemented by what we learn? How do they differ? How are they important? What's the deal there?
Yeah, I mean, I think that we talk a lot about what we learn. The content is often what's kind of foregrounded in education. But the how we learn is, I think, just as important. And the reason that I feel strongly about that is that we, you know, the world is changing at a pace that requires all of us to continue to be learners over our whole lifetimes. It's related to what we were talking about earlier in terms of the kind of unprecedented uncertainty and ambiguity that we're all dealing with right now, even just from the perspective of how quickly people's jobs and careers are changing related to new technologies coming in and our expectations that we need to keep using them. So the really having a strong understanding of how you learn, not just the content, I think is something that is important for us to be thinking about, whether it's about, you know, creating space for learning in a work environment, whether it's about how we're, you know, nurturing or mentoring young people in our lives, or particularly if we're in education. But I think that how is kind of, is we don't spend as much time focusing on it as we do the kind of the what of what we learn. And I'd love to see that balance shift a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I just want to go back, Sarah, because, you know, you point out in your book that change is a wonderful opportunity. A change in an organization is a wonderful opportunity maybe to pursue some of these design principles and tools. A lot of folks, you're dealing with that kind of a situation, as you mentioned, uncertainty, trying to pivot to whether it's remote telework or remote learning or just changing what we've gotten used to because of the situation we're in right now. But when you're in that context, how can we inoculate ourselves from what you call the deadly phrase of, you know, that will never work here?
Well, I will say that, you know, I think when the whole context is shifting as it has, you know, so rapidly, there you do see organizations and individuals like change more than we might be able to or think that we might be able to under normal conditions, which I think is, it's stressful and it's also instructive in terms of like our capacity to change. So in a way, I think as, you know, anyone who's in a leadership position, we should really be learning from the extent to which people were able to change and were able to adapt quite rapidly to a new context, and also what the costs and the downsides of that were. Because I think that there are some important insights about when we want to create change, when we want to create progress in our organizations, what we can learn from this situation. But the specific phrase that you're right, I really have an allergic reaction to that phrase. You know, that sort of like, oh, we've already tried that. That will, you know, that didn't work, you know, 10 years ago when we tried it, or that would never work here. You know, there's a lot about change that is scary. And part of it is that it's just hard to envision what it's going to be like on the other side of it. And so some of those practices that I described around, you know, things like shadowing, things like learning to look at the situation with new eyes, if you can get folks to go through that together as a group, there's a shared appreciation for what might be possible. And then, you know, another part of design work that we haven't touched on extensively yet is about storytelling, is about visualization, is about bringing these potential futures to life in a way that people can experience and play with and understand and see themselves in. And that's also part of managing change and part of, you know, inviting more innovation and more creativity into your environment.
Well, that's great, Sarah. Since you mentioned storytelling, why don't you elaborate more on the role of storytelling in design?
Well, I think, you know, it's often the case that when you have your sort of like brilliant new idea, or your team is working on something new, like it just makes, you're living in the universe of that new idea and it makes complete sense. But actually other people have to be convinced and have to be inspired for you to, you know, either bring them around to your point of view, or to, you know, raise some funding, or to get the permission in your organization to try something new. So we focus a lot with our students on the art of storytelling, because you have to be able to say, one, hey, there's, you know, a really compelling set of needs that we can solve for, and look at what the world might, you know, could possibly look like on the other side of that. So, you know, there are a few assignments in the book that are around storytelling, like around how do you create a short video that actually, you know, brings something new to life, or, you know, how do you use metaphors to paint a picture that grabs people emotionally, not just intellectually, about that kind of that future state that you're trying to create.
How can design principles and practices help government executives transform how government operates? We'll explore this question and so much more when the special edition of the Business of Government Hour returns.
How does an agency decide upon and implement a performance management framework that will be successful for their specific administration? The IBM Center report, A Practitioner's Framework for Measuring Results, follows the implementation and results of the CSTAT management framework in Colorado's Department of Homeland Security in hopes that it can guide others who may want to institute a similar approach. Download A Practitioner's Framework for Measuring Results by Melissa Wavelet on businessofgovernment.org today. Agile methodology has allowed for agencies to keep up with the growing demands for fast response to problem solving. The Opportunity Project, TOP, serves as a catalyst in adapting agile techniques to solve complex agency mission problems. TOP works with federal agencies to identify challenges and facilitate iterative approaches in response. In the IBM Center report, Agile Problem Solving in Government, Joel Gurin and Katerina Ribello discuss the factors of success involved in TOP. Download your free copy today at businessofgovernment.org.
This is The Center This Week, highlighting the latest trends and best practices for improving government effectiveness, brought to you by the IBM Center for the Business of Government. I'm Michael Keegan, managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The Center This Week is our opportunity to inform and, most importantly, to invite you, our listeners, to use the IBM Center for the Business of Government as your resource, a how-to resource for improving government effectiveness at the state, local, and federal level.
How can fostering a flux mindset help leaders be more effective and resilient in the face of relentless uncertainty? And what strategies can leaders employ to achieve a flux mindset? I will explore these questions and much more with April Rinney, author of Flux, 8 Superpowers for Thriving in Constant Change. How does one's mind get set? And where does one's mindset come from? What drives it? What are the characteristics, and you were alluding to it a little bit, of a fluxed mindset? And how does it build on a growth mindset? A lot of mindset in there, but I was wondering if you could help us understand that better.
One thing that's really interesting is that the concept of a mindset is actually pretty new. It isn't something that's been around for centuries. But over the last 30, 40 years or so, this concept of mindset has really started to gain traction. And I think today, most people know it thanks to this concept of a growth mindset, which was established by a Stanford psychologist named Carol Dweck. The growth mindset is very much in the context of children and how we learn. And it's looking at the fact that our state of mind, the way we think, what we think, how we feel, how we show up in the world, that our mindset can evolve as we grow and age and so forth, that it's not fixed. And so fixed mindset versus growth mindset is where a lot of these conversations get started. The difference with a flux mindset, and you know, I'm an enthusiastic believer in the growth mindset, but what a growth mindset doesn't do and what a flux mindset seeks to add is, what do we do when things change? How do we adapt to that? How do we react to that? It does require a growth mindset, but it also requires a mindset that is so radically, ridiculously comfortable with all kinds of change that it can't help but see every single change, even the hard ones, as an opportunity for growth and an opportunity to do things better.
More information on this and other Center resources is available at businessofgovernment.org. There you will find how the business of government is not business as usual. For the IBM Center for the Business of Government, I'm Michael Keegan, and this has been The Center This Week.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour, a special series focusing on leading through uncertain times. I'm Michael Keegan, your host. My guest today is Sarah Stein Greenberg, author of Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. I'm going to shift gears a little bit from understanding design, which you've so eloquently outlined and is really done well in your book, to seeing it in action. And so perhaps you could, Sarah, talk to us about some of the vignettes or case studies, if you will, that are offered in your book, specifically the work of Alex Lofton.
I'd be happy to. So Alex actually has a strong background in government and politics. And he, is a very, sort of socially minded, social impact minded entrepreneur. He studied at the D School while he was pursuing his MBA at Stanford, which is how I met him. And after school, he and a few of his friends got together, and they decided that they wanted to launch a company that would help people who were kind of at, in their 20s and their 30s, who did not have enough money to put together for a down payment, kind of crowdsource that support. So think about like sort of a Kickstarter for buying a house. Like, how could you, have a platform where your friends and family could help pitch in and help you raise that money to buy your first house or your first apartment? And they did a bunch of interviewing and experimentation and prototyping. Over time, they actually realized, that's maybe not quite the right idea. And they actually found a really compelling need that was kind of adjacent to that original need. And what they realized is that they could design a new company offering around providing support for educators who live in expensive housing markets to be able to afford that first down payment and buy a home, in proximity to the schools where they were teaching or leading. And that is a really difficult challenge for many, many educators at this moment in, markets where housing costs are really escalating. The Bay Area where I live is one example, but there are many around the country. And so they have a very innovative model where they're combining that sort of like real business savvy and knowledge of the market forces around housing. And they provide a ton of homeowner education for people who are first-time home buyers. And they partner with philanthropic organizations to help offset the cost of that first down payment. So they're doing really well. They've actually started expanding to other kinds of essential workers, including healthcare workers and others, and also expanding geographically. And that's a great example of all of the kinds of mindsets that we've been talking about, right? They went in with one idea, but they remained open to other ideas. Their early experimentation allowed people to give them real feedback, and they ultimately landed in a much better and stronger place than where they started. So that's one great example of kind of those same mindsets of, wow, and Alex didn't have a background in real estate going into it. But they, as a team, they really found their way through a lot of these, you know, very design-oriented behaviors.
So from your research, your experience, are there any examples of the application and use of these tools and techniques within the government management context? And how can government agencies use these tools and techniques to better serve and deliver mission-critical services?
You know, that is an area where I'm seeing a lot of new activity within in terms of bringing design more into the context of government. We did a project actually last year as the pandemic was really unfolding at the same time as the country was gearing up for the national elections, just in terms of how can we equip people who are running local polling places with the tools that they're going to need, because they are each going to be designing or redesigning the process of voting with all of these new health and safety considerations. And that is just one example. There are many cities and states now around the country that are starting innovation offices where they're sometimes blending design and things like behavioral science. I think there's quite a recognition that there's an opportunity to use design for some of these kinds of complicated systems level challenges, and particularly where, you know, the experience that citizens or members of the public are having when they're interacting with these services can be improved. And I'll just encourage, you know, anyone who's listening to go dig deeper into the story that I was describing before in the state of Michigan. That group has started a social impact design firm called Civilla. And the work that they are doing across the state, and I believe in one other state as well, around the redesign of the public benefits system is incredibly inspiring and is just a brilliant example of, you know, these are complex systems. It requires a long-term effort and a lot of commitment and a lot of, you know, bringing together stakeholders in a true collaboration to make the kind of change that they're starting to see.
Sarah, I really enjoyed your book, and I want to thank you for joining us today. How can folks get a copy?
You can go get a copy at our website, which is dschool.stanford.edu or dschoolbooks.com. And there are links there to order it from any of your favorite book retailers. So you can pick your favorite there.
Great. Thanks for joining me today. It was great to have you.
Thanks so much, Michael. I really enjoyed the conversation.
This has been the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors. A special series focusing on leading through uncertain times with Sarah Stein Greenberg, author of Creative Acts for Curious People, How to Think, Create, and Lead in Unconventional Ways. Be sure to join us next time for another informative, insightful, and in-depth conversation on improving government leadership and its effectiveness. Until then, subscribe, download, and listen to the entire interview at Podcast One, iTunes, or on your favorite podcast app. And as always, at businessofgovernment.org. For the Business of Government Hour, I'm Michael Keegan, and thanks for joining us.
How can government best use big data to transform decision-making, public services delivery, and communication? The IBM Center Report, Integrating Big Data and Thick Data to Transform Public Services Delivery, by Yan-Yan Ang, presents 5 recommendations for public managers introducing the concept of mixed analytics, urging thick data, meaning qualitative information about users, to be presented alongside big data to improve government decision-making. Visit businessofgovernment.org to read more.
WFED Washington, WTOP FM HD2 Washington, W283DG Sterling, WTLP FM HD2 Braddock Heights Frederick. Federal News Network is the news organization of record for the federal community. We are nonpartisan, non-political, and our job is to help federal government and contracting executives make informed decisions. We inform federal managers, contractors, and policymakers on issues related to the federal workforce, management, and acquisition, pay benefits and retirement, the Defense Department, and federal IT.
Portions pre-recorded.
Nights and weekends, we air Washington Nationals, Capitals, and Wizards, and the Navy Midshipmen. We are the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics. Download the Federal News Network app on the App Store or Google Play Store. Play Federal News Network on Alexa. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and LinkedIn. Federal News Network. Our mission is helping you meet your mission.